book is a survival manual if you read it right, or if you read it 15 times over the course of over a decade. My name is Sarah, and I did one of those things, definitely.
And my name is Amelia, and I'm the king of mold.
Nope. Why?
So, Sarah, you may recall that I did tell you that I had kind of a disgusting anecdote to share with you today, and you know, kind of was asking whether or not I should share this in a format that is accessible forever to all the denizens of the internet. But then I realized how foolish it would be for me to try to hide from the general populace that I am actually a disgusting filth goblin. So here we are.
Cool. Well, I've already asked one question to you about this story, so I know it's not about poop.
It is not about
poop.
And
that's all the information that I have.
To the best of my knowledge. I'd actually love for you to just continue guessing.
Okay, your feet are so dirty that when you rested them against the wall, it looked like there was a soot stain on there.
Well, firstly, that's not actually gross. That's just like, you know, that's just a thing that happens to people sometimes, you know. Just your feet get dirty. You're scrabbling around in the dirt.
That's a story from the time the house next to my brother's house caught on fire. And then the firemen came into my brother's house to see if there's any smoke damage. And they pointed to the wall and they said, looks like we got smoke damage here. And either my brother or his roommates had to be like, no, that's our feet resting place.
Wow, holy shit, I can't believe you just destroyed my disgusting anecdote. Well, okay, never mind, I guess. I found some weird fungus in my car, but, like, who cares anymore, right? I mean, really, what's Amelia gotten going on, right? Oh, yeah, you know, she's doing some other stuff, but, you know, Matt has meth mouth or whatever, so, like, let's talk about that.
My brother is a very cool man, and he does a lot of cool stuff, and some of his anecdotes really portray what it's like in very vivid detail to be a punk rocker in Philly. It's always sunny in Philadelphia, except for the foot stain parts.
Oh my god. So anyways, some background detail on my now defunct anecdote.
Love you, Matt. Continue.
So last year, as I rolled on up to Vancouver, Washington, and finally gave up the hashtag van life for the foreseeable future, over the next few months, I noticed that the 5-gallon water container in the very back of my car seemed to be decreasing in volume, despite the fact that I was using it.
God.
I assumed, because I didn't actually want to investigate it, that it was simply evaporating. And then I didn't think about it anymore, ever again. Except to maybe think, it smells kind of weird in here, but it's probably fine.
You... of 5 gallons of water. I'm trying to understand, is it, you just left that much water in the back of your car, or that it's a damp thing that you never open?
I'll provide some more visual information. It's essentially just like a big gallon, like big plastic water jug with a spigot, that I had been using as my, essentially, like, my water source in the van. And I was kind of like, well, I'm not going to dump out this perfectly good water, but I don't need it right now, so I'm just going to leave it there for, like, the next time that I'm in the van and I need a nice drink of really, really, really warm water that's been sitting in my car for, like, the past 8 months. But then the water levels started going down, and I was kind of like, that's weird. And then, you know, as you do, did not actually want to go all the way around the back of the car to investigate what might have been happening. And then the water was gone and it wasn't a problem anymore, so I just kind of forgot about it. until today, whence...
The water was just gone.
The water, I mean, you know, sometimes...
Yeah, no.
God moves in mysterious ways. He does
That's
what he will.
That's a pretty straightforward one. That's a real... Jesus's miracle wasn't just making water disappear. You know that, right?
I mean, the water had to disappear before the wine appeared. So, like, I'm just saying, it's not really. I mean, I think you're being really hard on me right now, Sarah. I mean, it's not irrational to, like, look at water that was there and now is gone and just think, huh, that just happens sometimes. It does literally happen. That's what evaporation is.
That's, yes, I guess that's true.
And the fact that it was in a closed container with no outside vent or area for it to evaporate from, I don't know, magic.
Oh my god, what's it look like? When did you crack it open? Did you crack it open with, like, an axe? Did you try and drink from it? And then just, like, I'm talking to, like, is this the ruins? Am I talking to the ruins right now?
The vine that snaked in there and sucked up all the water? That was certainly on the list of hypotheticals that I explored. But what ended up happening was I ignored it for a year, and then... At some point last month, while beginning the preliminary stages of cleaning out my car, I picked it up and I noticed that there was a small crack in the back corner of it, which I still have no idea how that could have happened. Again, you know,
Vine.
God moves in mysterious ways.
Plastic breaks down. You created bacteria that can break down plastic in the fucking microcosm of your car's water.
I know, and gallon. I actually saved the world in that sense, so you're welcome. Plastic waste, huge problem. Anyways, at that point, when I realized that the water had in fact been leaking out, over that period, that was probably about the minute when I went, uh-oh. But it was not until today when I finally, took out all of the carpets, I took out the bed, I took out literally every single last thing that was in the van so I could just do, like, a total deep clean in preparation to go camping again, potentially. And I was cleaning out the well that one of the seats went in when I noticed that there looked like there was a little bit of dirt that went, like, behind one of the other seats that's currently folded down and hadn't been unfolded in God knows how long. So I got out of the car and I unfolded it, and, like, opening a treasure chest full of biological material, it was like, suddenly, I entered this whole other world where there was, like, this weird little, like, ridge of stuff there. It was, like, kind of a seam, and then covering that seam, there was, like, this huge growth of, like, that kind of feathery gray mold that grows up around it. It was, like, about, like, probably half of a foot to 3/4 of a foot square, And I just kind of stared down at it for a minute in, you know, the kind of incomprehension that only happens when you see something truly horrifying and realize that you have literally slept a night with your head not 2 feet above it, and just went, uh-oh. And I just like to imagine what that must have looked like for, all of the
God.
Other... I think God knew what was coming. He had his popcorn ready. For the rest of the people on the street, as I'm, like, yanking all this stuff out of my car, you know, really businesslike, I probably looked super cool, let's be real. And then me just, like, opening the back of my car, staring at something, going back into the house, and just coming out with, like, a gallon of bleach in one hand and a gallon of detergent in the other, and then going back in and getting a gallon of fresh water and a thing of paper towels, and then going back in and getting, like, heavy duty, like, nothing will get through these fucking gardening gloves, and then spending literally the next hour scrubbing the exact same spot inside of my car.
And then going back inside and getting the gasoline and then pouring that into your car, and then going inside, getting a match, coming back out, wavering as you stand in front of your car, thinking, should I? Should I? But what if the spores can spread on the smoke? You don't know the horrible duty that you have to protect the world, but you don't know how.
And then Googling it really quick and realizing that gasoline is actually an antibacterial agent anyway, so it's probably fine, it's probably fine.
Is that true?
No, I have no idea.
Me fucking holding a patient down. Okay, the other antibiotics have not worked, but I have a suggestion.
Listen, it's a great twofold thing. I mean, you pour the gasoline on, and if it really, like, things are not looking good for this person, you just light them up and you end their suffering.
Do you, and I know we're having a fun jest here, do you think that death by fire is the best one we can come up with?
I mean, I'm just saying, I'm not saying it's the best death, but I'm saying, like, you know, in terms of, like, it's gonna be bad, but it's not gonna be long, you know? Being burned alive while poured with gasoline is probably, I mean, like, 30 seconds of the worst agony that anyone has ever experienced, and then you're good.
When Republicans talked about death panels in, like, 2008, and about how healthcare was supposedly going to be full of death panels deciding who would live and who died if we passed Obamacare, I think they're imagining what you're describing, where you sit someone down with cancer and you just say, have you ever thought about immolation?
Yeah, listen, it's all right, quick. Listen, you
it's
know,
cheap.
Healthcare in America, let's be real, is a fucking shit show right now. This is my doctor voice, in case that wasn't clear. You know.
That was not.
Okay, so, this is my doctor voice. Healthcare in America, you know, it fucking sucks. I mean, look, I'm a doctor. Like, any system that could allow that to happen, I mean, it's gotta be, like, fucking insane. Like, actually fucking insane. So anyways, you got cancer, it is terminal. Oh, you didn't know? Well, okay. Well, yeah, you know. Okay, well, stop crying. Yeah. It's not actually, you know, it's not that big a deal. People die all the time. And
I
now
mean,
you'll die.
Everything's terminal.
Everything's terminal eventually,
it.
You know? That's what I like to say when I tell somebody that they're gonna die in 3 months. Oh, yeah, 3 months to live, in case that wasn't clear. So anyways,
Let's see. Mold, you're disgusting. Detergent. We wandered off topic for a bit there. Bleach, filth. I was going to sleep in that car, which is super fun. I'm glad you're addressing that before.
Hey,
I
told
come to
you though, and
you.
I didn't have to do that, so I think that I'm the good guy, really.
Honestly, I want a clean bill of health from your car. From your
I
car.
I mean, there's
I
so much fucking
it.
Bleach in there. Like, I can't imagine what more I could do.
Feel like you're replacing one problem with a different, more bleach based toxin. Well, speaking of mold that festers on the earth, humanity?
I mean, I fully
good
agree
omens.
With that.
I don't think that was the best. Hold on, let me take another run up at this. The earth is your van. And sin
it's not gonna get
is
better.
The mold.
It's not getting better.
Okay, I'm Crowley. No, I'm Aziraphale. You're Crowley. We're both covered in mold. Is that anything?
Oh yeah, that's perfect.
That's perfect. Also, neither of us are Aziraphale and Crowley. We are both the telemarketers that get eaten by maggots. So yeah, this week we read Good Omens by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman. I read it largely at work behind my cash register for, I think, about, like, the 15th time.
And I read it until about a third of the way in, at which point I stopped reading it because I wasn't enjoying it.
Yeah. So we're going to have two very different takes, I think, on this one.
I would say so.
Yeah, so, why don't you start? So,
I would say that, you know, it wasn't necessarily that I wasn't enjoying the book. It was more just that, I wasn't enjoying the book, but I think that the reason that I wasn't enjoying it was also the fact that, like, I had literally just watched the TV show, and the book is very, very similar to the TV show. To the point where I was kind of like, you know, I already know beat for beat what's going to happen here, including, like, the actual dialogue, so I'm not really sure why I'm reading this, you know? So I just found it really hard to, like, continue through with that.
I mean, yeah, fair. The TV show is, like, such a faithful adaptation. It's actually, like, a bafflingly faithful adaptation. The amount of narration jokes that, like, seem like they would be difficult to get into a visual medium. The TV show is just like, no, we got Frances McDormand, and she costs a lot, so we're gonna make the most of her. She's gonna read a lot of this.
So how was it for you, you know, reading this book again after so long and then also having just seen the TV show? I'm assuming because you finished it that you didn't have my experience.
Well, I had some slowness in there, definitely. And part of it is the usual agonies of going back to revisit something that you used to like, but was written, for example, in the late 80s, early 90s. There were some things that really just made me cringe. Like, at one point, like, a character, like, a child just calls Aziraphale a nasty gay slur, and I, like, full-body cringed at that.
Yeah, me too. In fact, that was pretty much the point where I was kind of like, I'm not gonna finish this book, actually. Which, like, to be fair, yeah, I will say, this book, you know what, I'm not actually gonna make any excuses for it. That's fucking shitty, and I didn't like it, and that's one of the reasons why I decided not to continue reading it. So, you know, people shouldn't write that kind of shit. This book was written in the 90s, I believe, and I think that definitely shows. It's just kind of, it was more of a time period where you could just say stuff like that, and it could essentially just be like, you know, I'm assuming, you know, writing it, you're just like, okay, and whoever reads this is just gonna, like, either laugh it off or, like, you know, be like, huh, and then keep going. It's just kind of not, it's just nothing. It's written as if it's nothing, and that's kind of what bothered me.
Yeah, it's definitely, it is these jarring moments I find when I go and I read books written when I was a baby, basically, and they'll just be this startlingly casual homophobia in the language, of which Good Omens is an example of a trend. Like, it's like, I've seen it in other works that I've gone back to revisit, and it's just like, wow, nothing kind of makes clear how much we've changed language-wise, I think, than the casualness of this. It also adds, like, a weird thing with, there's, like, Angel's, Aziraphale is assumed by literally everybody who meets him to be a gay man, and I don't, there's, like, lines in the text which Angels don't have a gender and are sexless unless they really make the effort, and it's, like, sort of this weird thing of, like, well, like, everyone perceives him as a gay man, but he's not actually a gay man. And I feel like I've always just sort of gone, well, I mean, he is. Uh-huh. In a way that I do think is, like, supported by the text. Not that he's, like, a gay man, because I do think he's also a celestial being. But, like, I don't know, he's also a gay man. He's a gay, look at him. Read him. Read him.
Yeah, and I think
also racism.
I did not actually, I don't think I got to that part, or if I did, I was sort of skimming at that point. Do you want to talk more about that?
No, yeah, no, it's just, Newt's car has, like, some really cringeworthy, like, switching the L's and the R's, because it's, like, a Japanese-made car, but it's bad. So, it's Yikes. Just one of those things, yeah, it's just, it's cringy to read, especially from authors that I like.
Yeah, really, just like fucking two for one, you know. And it's kind of like a flip the coin of like, whose idea was that? And then the other person also condoned it, so like that doesn't even really matter at the end of the day.
Yeah, I'm hoping. I don't know. Like, I think obvious. I think. I mean, I still would list it as one of my favorite books. Like, I still tremendously enjoy it, and I think that there's a lot of really beautiful statements about humanity in it, and the reason those moments come across as so jarring because they seem so diametrically opposed to the central points of the book, you know? And I, like, I don't know. I kind of hope that Neil Gaiman mentioned that he is made some, like, quiet edits, or he, like, when he was going through, that he'd like to be updated in the next edition. He said he found, like, a mistake or something that, like, he's gonna, like, quietly fix. I'm hoping some of those, like, I wouldn't mind if, like, just a couple, just, like, just drop a couple slurs, you know? Just drop the one slur, make Newt's car a little less racist.
I do want, I think that is an interesting point, you know, because I'm sitting here being like, yeah, because if you don't remove some of those things, it's, like, even more reprehensible. But then I was kind of like, well, is that, like, a form of almost, like, you know, turning around and being like, yeah, yeah, it didn't happen, you know? Like, is it fixing a wrong, or is it righting a wrong, or is it actually kind of, like, pretending that you didn't make this mistake in the first place? And I think I lean more towards writing a wrong, because it's like, I would have liked to have been able to read this book without stumbling across that slur and suddenly having just being slapped across the face with it, essentially. And having that be a wedge that was driven between me and my ability to actually enjoy this book. And like you said, I think that many of the issues in the book actually came from a place of almost like thoughtlessness, you know, of like, oh yeah, and we'll just toss in a racist joke like we do back in the 90s. And that in a way, like going back with more mindfulness and being more educated and like correcting that element could actually be for the greater good. But what do you think about that kind of question?
I think you could go either way on it. I think especially since you have one of the authors, if one of the authors involved wanted to change it, I think that would be fair. And from what I know of Terry Pratchett's later works, I don't think he would disagree with it necessarily.
Oh, yeah, no, I wouldn't imagine so.
Yeah, and it is, again, it's like reading early Discworld books and then being like, wow, he got a lot better. How inspiring. I also don't think there's an obligation to edit it, though. It's more of a preference. I would like it if it was removed, but I don't think that you have an obligation as an author if you get a different printing to change those things. I think it is something that you have to deal with and weigh on your own, of the difference of going back and changing the text versus what you think now versus letting the original thing stand. I think it's complicated, but I think it's different from the, like, Stephen King being like, I'm going to add 300 pages to The Stand because I wrote it better now. Or yeah. George Lucas being like, I'm going to tweak the movies to make them better now. This is something I feel like almost be more akin to, we had a typo that went through the first time, let's get that.
Yeah, although, you know, and I think that, you know, one also crucial difference is that those first examples are additions as opposed to things taken out. And that the fact that it's not a typo, it wasn't a mistake, it was a decision that they consciously made, granted that it was a decision that they've made, you know, that maybe they don't agree with now, but that still was a decision that they made. But I think it's kind of a complicated question. I don't think there is, like, one right answer to it. And I'm in the same boat where it's like, yeah, I would prefer to own the edition that doesn't, that I could, you know, lend to a friend without being like, by the way, like,
mm-hmm. I can say, though, this definitively, there is no topic I want to discuss less about this book than the one we currently are discussing.
Well then, let's move on.
Yes. Because, I mean, I feel morally obligated to lead with those out of the gate, and they did. And that was, I mean, one of my biggest reactions to things that were different this time around reading it was going like, ah, yikes. But there was also plenty that I liked and enjoyed and still resonated with me. It was such a mind-blowing book when I was 12 is, like, my go-to age, but, like, I'm pretty sure it was around then. You know, it genuinely, like, made me think about God for the first time, and, like, even the concept of religion adding anything to the world, you know? Uh-huh. Before then, I'd never known religion could be a positive thing, mm-hmm. which is funny,
it's
considering
Good
Omens.
But, yeah, like, I totally get that, and I think it's mm-hmm. interesting.
I know. And now look at me. I'm, like, the designated, like, person who's like, I mean, not all Christians, guys. We gotta talk with a bit more nuance here. I'm, like, the designated, like, fucking religion defender at the leftist meetings. But, yeah. Also, it reminded me of, Do you want another embarrassing anecdote from when I was 12?
Oh, always.
Well, I was super into Crowley and Aziraphale, which at first I wasn't, but I was like Googling Good Omens and I was just like, what? Together? That doesn't make any sense. Let me read it.
But huh. That's where the poop comes huh. out.
I can honestly say I never thought that. Because I was fresh out of the Rent fandom, so I'd already gone, what? Mark Roger? Whoa, Slash? Weird. I guess I'm really open-minded for a straight person. And here we are now. there was, but, like, someone wrote, like, a ship manifesto for, like, why they were canon. And not just, like, why they were canon, why they were intended by the authors to be read as a romantic relationship, which is the kind of stuff that I used to care about. Now I'm just like, I don't give a fuck what the authors thought. They're banging. That's my approach to all fiction now. But they wrote about how Crowley and Aziraphale's last paragraph together, they go dining at the Ritz, and they mention that a nightingale sings in Berkeley Square for the first time ever, which is the ending scene of the TV show. And I remember going to my mother and being like, Mom, do you know about the song A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square? And she's like, yeah. And I was like, they reference it in Crowley and Aziraphale's scene. And she's like, okay. I'm like, because they're in love and they were meant to be. And Mom's like, yeah, sure. I just remember very earnestly explaining to her, like, look at all the textual evidence here. Clearly, this was intended to be a relationship. And I would just like to say I'm glad I got that out of my system with Good Omens and Heroes, the pairing Peter and Mohinder, which I also really thought was going to become canon.
That's fucking wild to me, babe. Like, that's no, really... I mean, trust me, it's great. Great stuff. But, like, canon?
You don't understand, because one time they showed a couple kissing, and then they panned over to Peter and Mohinder. And then why would they do that if it wasn't foreshadowing that this is the same kind of relationship? You know when people, you know, the John Locke conspiracy that John Locke on Sherlock was going to be absolutely canon, and that all the clues were being laid, and if you just understood, you would be able to see it coming.
I love how you're asking me if I'm aware of the John Locke conspiracy, as if I have thought of literally anything else ever since learning of its existence.
Yeah, I fell deep into the rabbit hole of investigating all the theories, because it was so achingly familiar to me of, like, that brief time when I thought not like, but there's like this, there is this sort of mindset you get in where you're like, I've read the text the correct way, and only I see the truth that the writers are trying to show me.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because it's like, I don't know, there is this obsession of like, what is the intent, you know? Not necessarily like, what is the text, but it's saying, like, what were the writers trying to do? And especially in Good Omens, where it's, like, a closed loop, you know, it's over, you know? There's not gonna be a Good Omens 2 where they just make out for six episodes, except that actually I think that probably is what the TV show is going to be. I mean, if you just look at the writer's intent, and, you know, it's all very clear right there that that's what's going to happen. I'm like, I say that, but like,
sequel?
I mean, come on.
Do you know about the proposed sequel?
No, I don't. Good Holy Omens. Shit.
They were gonna write Crowley and Aziraphale living in a bungalow by the beach.
And when you say proposed sequel, you mean it's currently in production, right? That's what you meant? The production sequel? The in-production sequel? I can only assume that it was a little slip of the tongue.
That was what Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett were tossing around, but they could never come up with a concept beyond that, which is like, bitch, don't need to!
I know, what else could you possibly want? That is fucking amazing, also. God, that's great. And you know what? And I think that that's actually an interesting counterpoint where it's like, well, if the author's intent was a fucking Good Omens 2, where it's just Crowley and Aziraphale hanging out and being fucking romantic roommates, like, that actually matters, you know? That, it does, it kind of is validating to know that the person who was creating these narratives actually was creating these narratives for people like you, you know? But at the same time, I think, especially in this day and age, and probably forever, because people are always going to be shitty, but it's also easy to get really frustrated that way, because it's like, you are trying to make, you have no control over what the author's intent was. You can control how you read the text and how you interpret it, but if you're trying to essentially attribute these things to a person who, you know, has their own beliefs and opinions about this stuff, there's it's a yes or a no, you know, and it's probably always going to be a no in my experience, so.
Well, yeah, it's like this interesting thing going on where people keep tweeting at Neil Gaiman to be like, can you confirm that they're gay and in love? And on the one hand, I'm kind of the category of, like, it's played so romantically on the TV show, not to hop, well, I guess, yeah, to hop back to the TV show. It is played with what seems to be romantic tropes and longing and all those beats. So it would be nice, you don't have to make it sexual to make it romantic, you know? For example, there's just, like, there's hand-holding out of practicality in the TV show, but they could also be hand-holding just for fun.
When do they hold hands?
They hold hands when they are talking to Adam. They also hold hands for much less plot-relevant reasons, or, like, not much less, like, dramatically written. They hold hands as they think they're going to die facing, Satan. And Crowley has his flaming, Aziraphale has his flaming sword back, and Crowley has a tire iron because he's fucking useless. Yeah. So there's, like, the part where it's like, yeah, I do wish, like, maybe there had been something in canon to make it, like, instead of to take the subtext to text. And at the same time, I don't need Neil Gaiman to tell me what's what, you know? Like, I don't need your permission or your I don't need your blessing, in a way. Yeah. It's weird to me to have people tweeting at him to be like, well, can you confirm? And it's just like, I get the impulse. Don't.
But we're not 12 anymore.
don't ask Michael Sheen to read your fan fiction, but only because I think he will, and it's gonna murder me.
Yeah, I mean, like, unless he was lying, he definitely did read fanfic.
Yeah, Amelia, I think I would die for Michael Sheen, and I'm worried to Google him in case there's, like, the first Google result comes up. We were just talking before we turned on the podcast about how desperately my mom wants us to watch the Gary Oldman Dracula.
Yeah.
We were just saying something, and we're just like, yeah, I mean, Gary Oldman is Dracula, what's wrong with that? And then we were both silent, and you were like, isn't he a creep? And I was like, yeah, I was trying to remember if he beat his wife or not, because I seem to remember that. And it's just, like, this frustrating thing of, like, just stop being terrible. Hey, also, I don't know why our conversation keeps circling so hard back to the disappointment inherent in the universe because people are bad.
I don't know, maybe because that's just, like, the true facts. That's, like, the real shit that we need to get out to the world.
I mean, not to sound like an optimist on Maine, but I think that, like, things can be good sometimes.
Huh, interesting point. Could you back that up with some evidence? I don't care, I don't want to hear it.
Oh, hey, here's my evidence. I would go to bat for Terry Pratchett's later books, while saying that the early books in Discworld have some weird, like, Asian racism.
So in this metaphor, because we were talking about Gary Oldman, and then we were like, yeah, everything's terrible. And then I was like, prove to me that everything isn't terrible. And you're like, Terry Pratchett got better. Are you saying that maybe Gary Oldman will have a comeback and then he won't be shitty anymore?
I don't care about Gary Oldman, whom I'm Googling right now to make sure that I'm accurate, because I feel like having raised that on this, I need to at least confirm whether or not I'm thinking of the right thing.
Yeah, that's probably, you know, wise.
There are assault allegations. So, I would say the biggest, I really liked the differences in the ways that Crowley and Aziraphale are characterized. I actually prefer, I think, the book characterization, because Aziraphale is, like, kind of down to murder from the get-go.
Yeah.
And I just think that's really sexy. And Crowley is absolutely useless from the get-go, and all the way through. And I think that's also really sexy.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think he is absolutely DTM, down to murder, in the show as well, but, like, he kind of tries to hide it more. He plays it a bit coy.
Yeah. I mean, he's gonna shoot Adam if Madame Tracy hadn't stopped him, but, like, you know, he would have felt bad about it.
Yeah.
Book Aziraphale would have shot a child and then gone to go get some cocoa.
Yeah, that is pretty hot, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, Crowley, and you'll have to remind me if I said this last episode, but I've been thinking a lot about why Crowley in the TV show seems so distinct for me from Crowley from the book, and I think it's literally just David Tennant is such a specific actor that everything he does carries his previous roles. Like, Crowley, him as Crowley is very similar to him as Kilgrave and as the 10th Doctor and as that one guy in Fright Night, you mm-hmm. know?
Oh god, like, he's so distinct.
Yeah. Also, what a weird, yeah. What a one to pull out.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying he's a bad actor. I'm just saying he's a very specific actor with very specific mannerisms. And so Crowley in the TV show is almost like a little bit like the 10th Doctor, you know? Or it's like a little bit like that guy from Fright Night. Also, wow, way to reference Fright Night, the remake in 2019.
I know, right? Hey, I liked that movie. Haven't seen it since, but...
Yeah, we saw that on our first road trip together.
We did.
In 2011, after we graduated high school and drove down to Savannah, Georgia, and I drove the whole time because Amelia didn't have her license.
Yep, and I've been fucking paying for that ever since.
I think we're even now, probably.
Oh, thank God. Oh, thank God. Oh, I'm finally free. I mean,
you do owe me a debt you can never repay for not getting your fucking license until you were, like, what, 19?
Well, I mean, I had you to cart my ass around, so, like, why would I?
Yeah, Amelia, that is the point that I am making. I also thought the TV show centralized Aziraphale and Crowley more, while the book did a better job of having a more decentralized story, so that I think the supporting characters like the Them and Anathema and Agnes Nutter actually do a little better in the book than they do on the TV show, where they're, like, if everyone's up for Emmys, they're clearly supporting, you know?
Uh-huh.
In this one, I feel like in the book, I feel like everyone's supporting, you know? No one's really the lead as mm-hmm. much. And I really think, firstly, I think I love the way Terry Pratchett writes kids. Neil Gaiman has said, and I think reading in the back of the book, they said that Terry Pratchett had more of a hand in the children, which is, like, so obvious. He's such a distinctive writer. Although, maybe it's this funny bit where they would talk about, like, they have no idea who wrote some lines, and they'd both, like, congratulate each other on having written it, and be like, that wasn't mine.
That's adorable. But yeah, that was actually something I was gonna ask, is, like, did they say how they actually wrote it? Because the co-authoring process seems so fascinating to me.
Yeah, so how they did it was Neil Gaiman came up with this idea that he mentioned at one point to Terry Pratchett, who thought about it for, like, a year and then, like, called him back and said, like, hey, are you doing anything at that idea? Because I'd want to. If not, do you want to co-write with me? Which they did. So Neil Gaiman at this time was working on Sandman. So he was working primarily on that. So I think Terry Pratchett said that he did the bulk of the physical writing because he could put Discworld on hold in a way that Neil Gaiman putting out a weekly or monthly or however the fuck comic books work story couldn't. Terry Pratchett would write in the early morning and Neil Gaiman would write late at night, and then Terry Pratchett would call him in, like, the early afternoon to be like, get up, I've written something really good and I need you to hear it.
That's amazing.
Because Neil Gaiman is essentially nocturnal at that time. They would read it back and forth to each other, and they said that their main goal a lot of times was just to make the other person laugh. And then they would sort of type it up, and they would be like, I think and again, this is all being pulled from the interviews in the back of the book that I have, but they would be like, you know, one person might have typed it, but who can claim ownership for it, like, for 2,000 words that were created after 2 hours of talking on the phone, writing it kind of verbally together. And then when they were editing it, they lived in the same house for a bit. And Terry Pratchett has a very funny anecdote about basically the grumpiest Neil Gaiman barely alive at his kitchen table before breakfast, because he was never meant to get up that early.
That's really cool. So pretty much Good Omens 2 was just like them writing RPF about themselves then, huh?
Good Omens 1 was kind of RPF about, oh, that's why Crowley has sunglasses he wears at night, because that's what Neil Gaiman was doing at the time, and Terry Pratchett put that in to make fun of him.
Terry Pratchett is, like, totally down to kill a child, so that's where that comes in.
Yeah, Terry Pratchett did give away his flaming sword, which then became the weapon that war wields and brings destruction onto mankind,
Was that explicit in the book as well?
That it's his flaming sword. Yeah.
Nice, nice.
Yeah. Good job. Which is kind of
up,
interesting.
Buddy.
It is interesting because it starts with like him being like, I wonder if I did. The book starts with him being like, I hope I didn't do anything wrong giving away my sword. And then it's like, well, a little bit maybe.
Yeah.
But it was like an initial kindness that had bad consequences.
Yeah.
And then like, Crowley's temptation of them is like maybe an initial evil that has good consequences, and so it's all just mixed up in each other, you know?
Yeah, and obviously that's like the point, you know? That's like,
yeah,
I think
that's what makes me so fucking horned up, Amelia.
Yeah, it's all just so ineffable.
It's also ineffable. Christ, I was trying to remember the password to some of my old accounts earlier, and I should have tried Ineffable if I was trying to hack into an account
from
2005.
That's so good.
Do you ever have to do that? Do you ever have to break into your old accounts by remembering what fandoms you were into?
No, because I've been using the exact same password since I was 15. My
you
online
are.
Presence could be decimated so quickly. It is a monoculture.
I will tell you one password I've used, because it is the most specific password. I've never used it before or since, and you would only get access to a Spanish textbook I briefly used online. But it was, iron, !! frost, made during the 2-day period where I was kind of into Tony Loki ship. Tony Stark and Loki.
That's amazing. Your passwords are so much classier now. They usually involve the word Dick or Tommy or like
69 or 420.
Exactly,
I'm pretty easily
exactly.
hackable as well.
Ineffable 420.
Ineffable 69. It's fucking unknowable. Ineffable 79. What's it mean?
Well, it's
10
better.
More.
Just
happy
blatantly
is a good
ripping
show.
That joke off from yeah,
yeah.
Happy Endings.
You know what else I love, Amelia? Hey, Amelia, what things do I love that Terry Pratchett does? That's too vague. Do you want me to just say it?
Yeah, just go for it.
Witches.
Gotcha.
Love me a good witch. And I enjoy that in the book, Agnes Nutter has a bit more of a presence. In fact, in the TV show, I thought that the voice of God was Agnes Nutter, which I thought was like a really nice touch. But then it turned out to be the voice of God, which I don't like as much. But I just like that Agnes Nutter like appears in the smoke at the end. And she's kind of the second to last image in the book. And the last image is of Adam, who is like the embodiment of humanity. Which I think the TV show ends up making a very similar argument of, like, humanity is this angel and this demon that have, like, they're not heaven, they're not hell anymore, you know?
Yeah, and in a way, humanity was, like, the product of their decisions, you know?
Yeah, which explains a fucking lot, can I just say,
yeah.
In terms of the state of humanity?
God.
Because there's a line, I think, there's definitely a line in the book where they're just like, imagine how badly it could have gone if we were at all competent.
That's a mood.
I can't believe they spend 11 years basically raising the wrong child, and then there's like barely any acknowledgement. In the TV show, I think there's no acknowledgement of whatever happens to Warlock later. Like, they could not give less of a shit about this boy.
Yeah, so firstly, I find it totally plausible that they did that because they're fucking morons. And secondly, what happens to Warlock in the book?
In the book, there's just a mention that Adam sends him to America with, like, his father. Like, I think it implies his father gets transferred back to America. And it's like Adam couldn't imagine a better... It's like some line like, you never forget your first friend, you know? Because they hung out together as they were being swapped. And Adam can't imagine a nicer thing to do to someone than to send them to America where they have lots of flavors of ice cream.
That's nice.
Yeah. It's interesting. The Terry Pratchett was apparently insistent that nobody die as a result of Adam's actions. So, like, the deaths are reversed. Including one death where a bunch of telemarketers get eaten alive by maggots. Or not, maybe. I don't know if they get eaten alive by maggots. They certainly get eaten by maggots.
And we're not sure at what point in the process they die. I don't think the maggots would stop to kill them before eating them.
So yeah. I probably didn't need to add the disclaimer that I did. And that's... the one thing, I think that's the one thing Terry Pratchett's always been able to say, that one was Neil. but bringing them back was 100% Terry, because, like, Neil Gaiman would have just left them dead, and Terry Pratchett was apparently like, no one can die because of Adam. You know, Adam has to reverse it all.
That's really interesting.
Terry Pratchett apparently had. It's like, especially considering the story behind it, where, like, Neil Gaiman came up with this original pitch, it makes more sense that, like, Neil Gaiman has more influence, apparently, in the beginning of the story, and Terry Pratchett has more influence in the end of the story, because definitely there's some strong, strong elements of Terry Pratchett in the ending.
Yeah, for sure.
There's this, oh my god, I was talking about witches. I got off track, but I love, you know, just to go back to witches. There's this quote that I've always found weirdly meaningful that I was really sad wasn't in the TV show, but it was, and unfortunately I lent my book to someone so they could read it,
and then you told me, but don't worry, I haven't memorized the entire book. That is,
I know. I'll also say I lent this to my friend and I said there is some you know, I was trying to, like, figure out, like, a way to put it. And she's like, oh, it was written in the early 90s? And I was like, yeah. She's like, homophobia and racism? I was like, yeah. She's like, yeah, don't worry, I got it.
Was this Catherine? I was
like, yes, it was. It was. So, yeah, there's just sort of a time period. I mean, not, like, racism is respect. Whatever. Back onto the topic of witches, which I do enjoy. The line is something like, it's Shadwell retiring as the witch hunter sergeant and hearing Adam's voice being like, you know, today, like, you know, we'll hunt the witches today and then tomorrow, you know, we'll hide and they'll hunt us. And there's just, there's something about the way that it was written of just like this idea of like, why shouldn't like the witch and the witch hunter like take turns in this game of being it, where it's just like ineffable's a really good word because you can just get out of describing something, but it definitely doesn't fit here, so I'll need to come up with an actual sentence. But it's almost this idea of the cruelty of actual witch hunts being so nonsensical and witches so obviously being cool as a theme that's literally developed in the book of, like, witches are really too cool for us to hunt anymore. Let's be witches instead of witch hunters. And the idea that, like, you play your roles and then the next day your roles are the same, but they're the opposite. And that they're changeable and this is fun and fine. And that's how it should be. Like, I don't... No, exactly. Like, I've never been able to figure out why I've always loved that paragraph about, like, just the idea of, like, swapping roles and taking turns. But I have. It's one of those things that... Oh, man, you ready for, like, a lofty sentence? But it's always sort of read, like, prose poetry to me, where, like, I don't quite know why it resonates with me so strongly, but it is something that I really, like, I think about a lot, and it's probably the passage from the book that I think about the most for the reason that I love witches.
It's really interesting, and I think that, like, there is something there of, like, the idea of these, like, deeply entrenched systems of oppression are at their heart so meaningless and so childish that they might as well be a game, you know?
Mm-hmm. And that there's something to be gained in both the role and adopting the other person's role, you know? It's almost like heaven and hell. Like, Aziraphale and Crowley at the end are still an angel and a demon, but they've spent so long doing each other's roles, you know? Like, literally, the thing I always wanted from the TV show expanded their relationship, but they didn't give me this, which is I have always wanted to see Aziraphale filling in for Crowley to do a temptation.
Yeah,
that would be great. I always have wanted to see that, and no one will give it to me. Neil, why? But, like, you know, they literally have been doing each other's jobs. Be like, you're up in Scotland, do you mind doing, like, this blessing, and I'll cover, like, you know, your temptations down here. The idea of, like, these roles are meaningless, but still a distinction that matters in so much as it gives people something to play off of and to play against. I think I might be talking about gender now. Like, the binary is like, it's not real, but we kind of need it. But, or like, we like it, but like, maybe only in the way that it allows us to reject something. Yeah. Fuck yeah. Hold on, I gotta write my queer theory essay on Good Omens.
Oh boy.
Well, we should probably end it there.
Yeah. So, this has been Crack Spines. Thank you, everybody, for listening. If you want to check us out on social media, we are at crackspinespodcast.tumblr.com, at spinescast on Twitter, and you can email us at crackspinespodcast@gmail.com.
Yes. You can also get in contact with us by receiving a book from your long-dead ancestor, and then burning it in a fire. Our face will appear in the smoke, and we will approve of what's happening. So that is another way that you can contact us in a pinch.
I mean, the thing is, Sarah says you can contact us. The fact is, you actually can't contact us in any way. We suck at responding to messages. We're so sorry.
We are, elusive.
We are.
And
ineffable.
We are fucking ineffable. We are so deeply ineffable. Oh, and also, one last thing. The first time I read Crowley and Aziraphale's drunk conversation the night after Crowley delivers the Antichrist, and they're just, Crowley is trying to, like, convince Aziraphale that they should stop the apocalypse, and Aziraphale is too busy thinking about how gorillas make nests. That is the first time I could remember laughing so hard at a book I could not continue reading it.
That is amazing. All right.
Yeah. Anyway, this has been Cracked Spines, and I'm just saying, so the song, A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square, why would you include it? Why would you include it if it's not an explicitly romantic moment?
I'm gonna stop
Open your third
now.
Eye. Open your third eye. It's canon. They love each other, and they don't have to have sex, but if they do, they would like it.
And all that.